Guys. Hello. So that was great. What a great introduction to this whole series. As an artist, it's good to think about that the creative impulses that I have, and think about all this the beauty that we see all around us, and try to comprehend maybe some of God's thinking in those same terms. You put up that first slide. This is one of my favorite works of art. It's by Bruce Nauman. And it's, if it's a little hard to read, it says, "The true artist helps the world by revealing mystic truths." And I love the way he put it in big, flashy neon, just to make sure nobody missed the point. So I would like to talk today about Christ as in the terms of creative artistic process and some of the giants of art in the 20th century, a few. And I thought that I should give you guys a little bit of a background in my own work, so that's a good progression, right? I think probably I should get my work out of the way first, and then maybe go on to some of those other guys. So, for the past, about 20 years or so, most of the work that I've been making is temporary. A lot of it's outdoors. I find stuff and put it together. I kind of concentrate on those things that are everyday, that are repetitive and maybe overlooked in the course of our day-to-day lives, those little insignificant interactions that we have. So one of the things that I did several years ago now was called Baltimore Legends. And we were living in Baltimore at the time, and I took about a 9-square block area downtown. And I'd been noticing where people wrote their names in the sidewalk, in the wet cement. There were some goofy things written in the sidewalk. Some of them I can't show in church. But I decided that I would bring these to people's attention. So I went to Starbucks and got a big bag of used coffee grounds. So I chose this area and I filled in all of the names that I could find. So they were suddenly very high contrast. And I made little postcards, I had them printed up, and I gave them to all the stores in the area for people to see. And it was just like a little, you could walk around, they were all numbered, and you could walk around and see these things. And it was a lot of fun. I had conversations while I was making them with some people who told me, like, "I've been, walking to work this way for years, and I've never noticed that on the sidewalk." So that was cool. That one's hard to see. That was with, instead of coffee grounds, it was with orange lentils. Brilliant idea that my wife thought of. It says Peeper 75. I actually met the guy who wrote that in the sidewalk while I was doing it. And there's iguana. There were I think, about 15 names. And then 2 days later, a giant rainstorm washed everything away. That's pretty much how my work works. It either gets washed away or thrown out, or something happens to it, so I haven't been making a lot of money through my art recently. But I was working in the city and living in the city, and we moved out to the suburbs, and I found myself still going into the city to make my work. And it got to be this really weird, like, almost colonialist thing where I was going into these neighborhoods where I no longer lived and bringing in my art for everyone's edification. And it got to be kind of weird. So I realized I needed to look a little closer to home, try to make suburban art. And so nowadays I make work in the woods behind my house. There's this little place, it's called Matthew Henson State Park, but it's really just like where they couldn't build houses because everything drains into the creek there. I'm fascinated by this little place because of all the different uses that go on. There's a really nice walking path there, and kids ride their bikes and things. And there's all these empty beer bottles in the woods. where people get together and drink. So instead of picking these up and throwing them away, I decided I would make these little lights out of LEDs and watch batteries and just stick them in the bottles. I did it one day just as it was getting dark. And so as it got darker, these bottles just started glowing. And you could see there were a ton of them. I was looking at these things that might be an eyesore, might be something that people didn't appreciate, and just trying to see them, trying to reimagine their value into something that maybe is a part of the natural world, because I mean, we tend to think of ourselves as something apart from nature. So that's what I've been doing. So I'd like to talk now about some other guys, the granddaddy of this rethinking, reimagining type of art making. Was this guy named Marcel Duchamp. He was French. He started making art right around the turn of the century. And he emigrated to America in 1915. He was kind of escaping World War I. And he was already a pretty big deal. He'd been painting with the Cubists. He'd had some paintings sent to the U.S. that had caused kind of a big stir. So when he got to New York, he was pretty well known. And he was part of this group called the Society for Independent Artists. And they had a big show where anybody could put in a work of art. You pay your $4 and you put your art in this. And so under an assumed name, he went and he bought a urinal from a hardware store. And he signed it, R. Mutt. He had a friend submit it. So even though he was on the board for this organization, they didn't know he had done it. And he submitted this as a sculpture called Fountain. It blew people's minds. There was a huge uproar. They ended up not exhibiting it. They said, no, this was not art. And then there were editorials written, yes, it was art. And it really caused a tremendous stir in the community. And it's still causing a stir. In 2004, the Tate in London, the Tate Gallery, polled a group of 500 arts professionals. They voted this work as the most influential work of the 20th century. And it's nearly 100 years old now. People are still disturbed by this. And so I'd like to, because this is Cedar Region, this is what we do, I just thought we could take like maybe just 2 minutes. You could turn to the people around you and maybe just tell each other what you think of this work. Is it art? Is it just a urinal? I'll let you guys do that for just a minute. Oh, okay. All right, you guys are awesome. I teach high school. As Matthew said, and I don't get nearly this kind of enthusiasm most mornings when I ask my students to discuss art. It's a 3-minute video of a discussion about this work of art. Again, the Tate Gallery in London. I should mention there are 17 official versions of this urinal, owned by different museums and collectors around the world. And the Tate has one, and they exhibited it in a public restroom and asked people to discuss it. So if we can look at that, just and you can see whether people are agreeing with you guys. I think probably there will be a lot of agreement.
I think he intended it to be thrown out of the exhibition when it was first created.
Do you think so?
Yes, definitely.
Do you think it's still provocative?
No, because so many things have happened in the meantime that provoke us a lot more.
He certainly created a certain amount of provocation, and I wonder whether he therefore designed it not to be in the exhibition because of that.
I don't find it beautiful. Like, when I look at it now, I just see an idea.
I mean, I personally don't like it as a piece of art, but I don't think that matters at all.
Yeah, I don't think it's shocking now at all.
And I actually see something that, personally, I think it's a bit of a half-baked concept. It's not really doing what a urinal is supposed to do. Therefore, it's altered quite a lot to try and provoke a reaction.
And he obviously thought it was quite funny to do it, and I suppose I like the humour in it.
He wanted to make the point that craft isn't an important element in art. It's more the thought.
He was saying, you'll accept anything as art, won't you? And they didn't, actually.
It's a piece of porcelain. It's a toilet. Its only value is the idea that he assigned to that at the time.
The activity and the discourse and debate that happens around it's crucially important. I mean, it's led to artists doing things in hugely different ways.
Yeah. This is the kind of thing that drives me loopy. In one way, it turns me into a schizophrenic. In one way, I look at it and I think, oh, for God's sake, it's a toilet, it's a urinal. But in another way, I go, ah, but everyone's going to go crazy about this. Everyone's going to start fighting and arguing and saying it's rubbish, and others are going to say it's wonderful. And I love that then. I love it.
And I just sort of find the concept of us all standing in a toilet, looking at a toilet that's not a toilet, a bit more interesting than the actual object itself, you know.
It's been reproduced extremely carefully to replicate a throwaway object. It's bizarre.
But then the critics and the art historians come along and say, oh, this has a value because of X, Y, and Z.
It's true. It's one of the biggest seismic shifts, not in art, just in our culture.
And, you know, if you walked in here and just saw that, you'd say, oh, somebody's not forgotten to mount that on the wall.
Many, many people would say this is the most important work of art of the 20th century.
If you have to be told how good it is, it's not that good.
If you look at him as a painter, you know, he wasn't just somebody who created ideas, you know, he created paintings too.
And they were aesthetically nice, yeah.
And they were wonderful and they were well painted.
It's a matter of opinion. If you think something is elevated to the status of art, then it is because of that.
How do we then, in the art world, quantify what is good and what is bad generally?
You don't.
Is that a good
Everyone
thing?
Has a personal opinion, yeah.
Which makes it art. So anything that encourages lively discussion in this kind of manner is art.
Mm-hmm. All right, I love the guy who says we're standing in a toilet talking about a toilet. It's not a toilet. And the discussion is more interesting than the thing. It would be funny to actually be standing in the presence of this and then talking about it as this great work of art. But so at first glance, Duchamp's just kind of ruined this for everybody. You know, he says, well, anything is art. If you say something's art, it's art. I love how somebody had to go back and say, oh, but he could also paint. His paintings look really nice. So he must really be an artist. But Actually, Duchamp wasn't saying that. Duchamp was very specific that he was the one who picked out this object. And he couldn't just pick out any object. He did maybe a dozen ready-mades in his lifetime. But he always acted like the choice of the ready-made was a really hard decision. And he was the only one who could make it. He was asked if, well, you know, isn't the guy at the factory who made this toilet an artist? And he said, no. He didn't know what he was doing. He thought he was making a toilet. I'm the one who took this and gave it a new purpose. And this was an anonymous editorial that was written when they refused to show this work. The artist who chose it and gave it a new thought and a new purpose is the only one who's the artist. And it's not for everybody. It's only for those special few artists to be able to do. And so art gets separated from the production. It gets separated from any skill that's involved. It gets separated from any usefulness. In order to make it art, you have to take something that's useful and recontextualize it so it's not useful anymore, and then it can be art. And so it depends on this collective belief. I imagine the original urinal got thrown out. They couldn't find it anymore after this show. And so ironically, once people were interested in buying these because it was such an important work of art, they had to hire somebody to actually custom make urinals that looked like the original urinal. They couldn't just go to another hardware store and buy whatever the urinals were like, you know, 10 years later or 20 years later. They custom made ones that looked like the original. There are 17 of them in the world. And so it's this provenance that you can trace these back, and that Duchamp actually signed off on these and said, yes, I certify this as art, that is the important thing for museums and curators. So now, let's bring Jesus into this conversation. And Jesus did plenty of creative acts, you know, throughout the Bible. But I think probably his most famous act of reimagination would have been at the Last Supper, when he takes the bread and the wine and he says, this is my body, this is my blood. And I got to think that it was a pretty dark, anxious time for Jesus. He knew he was going to be betrayed and killed. And his disciples did not have a very good track record of actually getting what he was saying, which I can understand. I mean, if I was there and Jesus said, look, I'm about to be killed, I would probably think, oh, you mean you're about to almost be killed, but then bam, you're going to come up with a miracle and defeat the Romans and do all the things that we're expecting you to do. Because that's just the way we are. So Jesus needed to make sure that this work that he was about was going to be continued, and he only had us to rely on. I'm not a theologian, so if I say something that totally is the opposite of the way you understand the Bible, I apologize. I'm an artist. But it would have been, I think, a lot easier, and we would have gotten it if Jesus had chosen the obvious, like, you know, the sacrificial lamb, which obviously was made. I mean, Paul in 1 Corinthians calls Christ the Passover lamb who has been sacrificed. If Jesus had just said, look, every time you kill this lamb, think about how I am about to be killed for you, we'd get it. But he didn't. Jesus chose the most mundane materials. He chose bread and wine, which at that time were consumed by just about everybody every day. I mean, that's what there was to drink. I've read that wine would be typically, it'd be like one part wine, four parts water, and kids would be drinking it. That's just what you had to drink. You ate bread, you drank wine at least once a day. And these are the things that Jesus said, I'm going to take this and reimagine it as something much greater. So at first glance, he's doing what Duchamp did. He's the artist, and he's saying, you know, this now bring becomes something much cooler than this very mundane thing. But according to Paul, Jesus said, do this as often as you eat it, as often as you drink it, to remember me. So he's not only reimagining the bread and the wine, but he's reimagining the artistic act itself as an act that's available to everybody. It's not just for the special artists to be able to do. Everyone can reimagine these mundane things as something much greater. So this reminds me of another artist. His name is Joseph Beuys. He was German, became an artist just after World War II. He was actually a pilot during World War II for the Nazis. He was shot down. There's crazy stories about all of that. Then he became an artist and an art professor at the Dusseldorf Academy of Art. And he was very charismatic. He had this persona that was very important, where he wore the same thing all the time. He would wear this fishing vest with lots of pockets, wore his felt hat, and he got in trouble teaching at the Dusseldorf Academy because he refused to limit the size of his classes. And he was so popular and charismatic, his classes were overflowing. And the kind of art he talked about, he talked about the artistic act of creating a better society. And he famously said, every human being is an artist in this work, this social sculpture of making the world better. And just was attracting flocks and flocks of young people. You can see his adoring student over there gazing at him. And they would even start taking these chalkboards and varnishing them, and they became part of his artistic output and would get sold to museums and things. So, I mean, you can kind of see this, at least to me, he's thinks of himself or has created this persona that's a very messianic figure. He's saying, this artwork is about making the world a better place, and you are all involved in this artwork. But at the same time, the rest of the work he was doing, here's a piece from 1965. It's called How to Explain Pictures to a Dead Hare. And he locked himself in the gallery, so you could only see it through the windows of the gallery, the glass doors. He covered his head in honey and then in gold leaf. So his whole head was gold. And he had this dead rabbit. And for 3 hours, he would talk to this rabbit, show it the paintings, move him around. He had a piece of iron strapped to his left foot, so he'd be clanking around in the gallery. You couldn't hear what he was saying because you were locked out. So I have a really quick video of some of this, just so to put us.
Das Bild, das Beuys uns mit dieser Aktion hinterlassen hat, ist eine seiner stärksten. Sperrt die Zuschauer aus. Wie in einem Schaufenster agiert als Held der Erschöpfung. Produziert Gesten und Bilder, die einfach sind, aber nicht banal. Bis heute ist man als Zuschauer neugierig und verwirrt. Die Handlungen, die Beuys in den Aktionen vollzieht, sind nicht aufzulösen in Begriffen wie Schamane, Messias oder Kommunikator mit einer anderen Welt. Sie haben eine innere Notwendigkeit. Erlösung bieten sie keine, doch sie stellen die Sinnfrage, sprengen verkrustete Denkmuster.
So that's pretty indicative. That's actually a really famous work that he did, How to Explain Pictures to a Dead Hare. Now, I mean, I see that and I'm actually really intrigued, you know? I know something's going on, but I have no idea what's going on. And he would be very happy to explain what was going on, and that's what he did. He'd say, well, look, the iron on my foot symbolizes this, and the honey and the gold on my head symbolizes this. And it's this crazy symbolic system that he knew about, but we didn't know about. And without his explanation, there's no way we could know about it. And a lot of times, I think that we can feel that way about Christ's work as well, about Jesus's artistic output. And I think this is also how the disciples would have felt, where on the one hand, they're being told, all right, you guys are going to go out and do my work. And they're also being told, if you had faith that was the size of a mustard seed, you could tell this mountain to move and it would move. So obviously you don't. You don't even have that much faith. But I'm going to need you guys to do my work because I'm about to be killed. And you're going to continue on. So we have this kind of disconnect between the work and the expectations that leaves me feeling, pretty inadequate. Not up to this task. So I have to believe that Jesus was keenly aware of this gap between the idea and the realization of the idea, between his plan and the execution of that plan. And this gap is a really fertile place for artistic activity. So this brings us to our last artist of the talk. His name is Saul LeWitt. Doesn't look as charismatic as the other two guys. He wasn't as concerned with his image. But in the late 50s, the early 60s, abstract expressionism was still going strong. People were painting these giant bombastic paintings. And a group of artists was trying to strip away everything that wasn't needed anymore to see, you know, how much could they really get rid of and still have art. You know, the abstraction had already gotten rid of anything that you could actually say, oh, that's a piece of fruit, or that's a person. But so the minimalists tried to get rid of things like emotion. You know, the abstract paintings were still full of emotion and angst. And they said, you know, is that really necessary? Saul came up with these sets of directions for making art. And he said the idea of the art becomes a machine that makes the art. So he'd just come up with a set of directions and then follow the rules to see what he had come up with. So here's one of his, wait, do we have one before this? Yeah. Here's a suite of his etchings that got made, where all he said was, I'm going to take lines that are pointing to the cardinal points, and I'm going to present each of those lines and then every possible combination of those lines. So it's pretty simple. There are only 15 total. But that was it. There's no emotion involved. It's just, here's a set of rules. Let's see where these rules lead us. And so that was his deal. But he started making these drawings on walls, and they got bigger, and the instructions got more complex until they would take, you know, it would take days to make one of these works, and he couldn't do it himself, so he would hire other people to help him. And eventually, he just had other people carrying out his instructions. And he said that the art was his idea. And then putting the art on the wall was really just like a byproduct. So he was more like a musical composer. And then the people who did the work were the performers. Not that the performance isn't also art, but the idea behind it was the thing that he was concerned with. So here's one of these drawings and the instructions for it. The titles of the drawings kind of became the instructions. But can you just quickly go back to that for a second, Mike? So he says, take a wall, doesn't matter what size the wall is, because you're just going to divide it in half. And then each of those halves, you're going to divide into four parts. And you're going to draw lines the way I tell you to draw them. And it's going to make this work. And he would often include a handy sketch to help people out. So on the first half of the wall, you just have lines that go in one direction or another direction or another direction. And then the right-hand side of the wall, you do the first set of lines And then over that, you would put the second set of lines. And then over that, you'd put the third set of lines. And I mean, so it sounds simple, and it really sounds kind of boring. Here's that drawing being made. It was actually two drawings, one in color and one in black and white. Sorry you couldn't see the whole thing better, but you got the idea with those details. I mean, it was tens of thousands of lines. And in the actual instructions, he was very specific. So I think those probably looked like they were, what, like a quarter of an inch apart, parallel lines. He'd tell people all of that. The one on the left was done just in black graphite, and the one on the right was done. Each line was a different color. He had a particular brand of colored pencil that he would like people to use. So there wasn't a lot of room for interpretation. And I don't know about you, but I would hate to make a drawing like that. I mean, just the idea of having to get each of those lines measured correctly and parallel would drive me insane. No wonder he hired other people to make the work. But they weren't all like that. And there is, right now in Boston at Mass MoCA, there's a retrospective of his wall drawings. There's at least 100 drawings. And the show's going to be up until, the website says the show's going to be up till 2033. Because, I guess just because it took so long to install all these this work. So I haven't seen the show yet, but the website is great, and I have to go up and see them. So the two that I've picked to show you they're both black and white and kind of minimal, but some of them are much crazier and bolder. If you want to Google him. But so this next drawing, there's a lot more room for interpretation. He basically says, draw a line about 18 inches long. And then from the midpoint of that line, draw another line that's 18 inches long. And then just keep going and cover the wall and make it look fairly even. So they don't have to be parallel anymore. He's giving us a lot more room to play around with his directions. So here's a really quick time-lapse video of that. like these drawings because you can, you know, there's something for everybody. I think, you know, looking at the last drawing, I know some people would think, yeah, this is me. I really like things orderly and step by step. And when I look at this drawing, this reflects my life a lot more than the previous one. Every once in a while you step back from it and see where there's a part you could put in a little more work, but the whole thing looks pretty chaotic. So again, the way these are set up, you can really be any size wall. The instructions just let you adapt them to the space, mostly. And somebody asked him, okay, so if somebody got hold of your instructions without your permission and did one of these drawings, would it still be your work of art? And he said, yeah. Sure, it was my idea. And anybody who does one of these, it's an original Solowit. So this is kind of a dream of mine to own an original Solowit. And we actually have a big empty wall in our house. And one of these days, I would love to install one of these works so I can own an original Solowit. It's very hard to get the actual instructions. They're not published very often. Just for that reason. I mean, he would sell these to museums and collectors, the form of it would just be a piece of paper with, you know, the instructions typed up and maybe a drawing and his signature, and you would own the idea, and then anyone who you wanted to give permission to do the drawing could, but you still retained the right to this idea of the drawing. So it's very important for the museums, for the curators, for the art dealers to maintain the lineage and the hierarchy, and for them to consecrate this work before it's presented to the masses. So you can maybe see where I'm going with this. When we come to church and have communion, we get to say the right words and make this connection very clear between Jesus' act and what we do. And it makes it easier to believe that we're getting the genuine article. We're assured of the work's authenticity. But Christ's revolutionary creative act was to do away with the intermediary. Although we still don't need you, Matthew, and appreciate you. But at the Last Supper, Christ validated this as his original continuing work, no matter who facilitates it, as long as it follows his original plan. He says, whenever you take in these things that sustain you on a daily basis, you can remember that I sustain you on a daily basis. So there's one last question, which I think is kind of unavoidable, and that is, if the idea is the work, do you really need to make the drawing at all? You know, I can read the instructions and kind of imagine what that would look like and go, oh yeah, that's a pretty cool idea. But to actually go to a museum and experience one of these up close so that it engulfs you, and you can see the gradations, and you can see the way the colors blend, it's just so much nicer than just trying to imagine it on your own. The idea can look so simple, And the manifestation of that idea can be so much more beautiful than I could ever have imagined. And obviously, I think that's what happens here in this room when we come together. I can just read in the Bible about that Last Supper and go, great idea, God, and not ever have to replicate it. But when I do replicate it, something that I could not have even imagined happening might happen, and especially when I'm able to share that with others. So the true artist helps the world not by intellectualizing mystic truths or pondering mystic truths, but by revealing those mystic truths. And as Christians, we believe that Christ is that mystic truth revealed to us by being made one of us, made human. So Christ's boldest creative act, I think, on that night was not just to reimagine the bread and the wine, but to reimagine each of us as himself. Imagine us as somebody who actually is capable, despite our lack of faith and despite our inability to comprehend the big picture, capable of bringing about his ongoing work.